And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host. We have a great show with our guest is the retired Captain Robert Salas, who was there in 1967 during a UFO observation when several nuclear missiles shut down one by one. These were all independently controlled and not connected together. There was no answer that the military could come up with. And of course, guess what? They tried to hide it. So we're going to be talking to him about his testimony. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas from Open Minds Radio, and he is going to be on talking about the latest UFO events. Well, I'm really excited about this because we're at the year's end and we have a great contest for you out there. Get a pen and paper, or if you forget anything I'm saying, it'll be in our show notes how to enter. You can win a brand new iPad mini, and I will send that anywhere in the entire world. If it's off planet, it's going to be some extra postage, I'll tell you that. Well, here's what you have to do. You go to Gemmer, which is gemmer.com, G-E-M-R.com. And by the way, Gemmer is a social community for collectors to share, trade, and connect with other collectors. It's a great website and a fun experience. The next step is you need to register. And that is very easy. You can do it through Facebook or Google, or you just sign up through an email address and you need to get a username. Then you need to post something, some sort of a collectible or something, and you can post a whole bunch of things. I did a bunch of art pieces really quickly, real easy, simple, and intuitive. So now your last step is, and you can't forget this or you can't win, you need to take your username and put it in the subject line of an email and send it to contest@gemmer.com. And that, again, it's all right on my website. You can go there if you forgot anything. So it's only going to take you a few minutes. And if you don't win the iPad mini, we are also drawing five runner-ups of swag bags with some cool stuff in it. It's really worth your while. Check it out. The site is great. You're going to really enjoy it. And just once again, to win this brand new iPad mini or fun swag bags, go to gemr.com, register, post as many items as you'd like, send an email to contest@gemmer.com with only your username in the subject line. Alrighty then, and if you've missed the last few shows, I have to fill you in real quickly. The first hour of the show is free to anyone who wants to listen, still an iTunes, Stitcher, and all that. The second part of the show, for only a dollar a month, which is about 23 cents a week, you can listen to the second hour of the show by going to getjoyride.com/podcastUFO. Again, it's right on our website. Check it out. And that is about it. And we are ready to bring Alejandro on. How you doing, Alejandro?
I am doing wonderful. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. You know what? Next week is Christmas Eve, as I'm sure you're very well aware.
Next week is Christmas?
It is already.
Oh, my gosh. I better start doing some shopping.
Yeah. Hey, it's never too late, I say, because, I'm one of those last-minuters myself. But you know what? I got a guest on the show. Can you believe that? And I just pulled it off a couple of days ago. I told him that we didn't have any openings for 6 months. No, I didn't really. But anyway, he was kind enough. It's Frank Fascino, I think it is. How you say his name?
I think it's Frank Fascino, like fresh.
Oh, Fresh Fascino.
I think
Junior
so.
On the Flatwoods Monster. That's always been an intriguing case to me.
Mm-hmm, very much so.
Yeah, so he'll be on. So I was excited about that.
Yeah, that'll be cool.
I was going to be all by my lonesome next week. And I don't I don't like that. So I can't. I've had enough technical difficulties lately where I realize that I'm not one of these people that can carry on like Art Bell or someone like for 4 hours by myself with no one talking.
Talk about Christmas and
yeah. I like Santa. I hope you listeners like Santa too.
That was a pretty darn good imitation of how I'd handle it. So what's hey? I saw a thing on your Facebook page that was pretty exciting. Do you want to talk? You're talking about that? I'm assuming
the chili thing.
Yeah,
I am talking about that. Number one on my list for UFO news this week is the Chilean government-sanctioned UFO organization CEFA-A, who is they went to France in October and they met with another government-sanctioned UFO organization. There's not many, but France does have one called GEPAN. GEPAN is under CNES, which is France's version of NASA. And Chile, they work under the DGAC, which is kind of their version of the FAA. But there's an organization called the 3AF out there in France. And they're kind of an aeronautics and astronautics association, a society. And they aid Francis Japon in the scientific study of UFOs. So Chile CEFA went out there to meet with them, and they signed an agreement where 3AF is now going to help Chile also with their investigation of UFOs. So I think this is really cool and really important. This 3AF is an important organization. They would be most similar to our American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And this is kind of a society that, you know, everybody in this field, especially people who want to network and be known, you know, join the society where they talk about all of these various things going on, sending things to space, building planes, all of this stuff. So it's a very important organization. It's one of the four biggest in Europe of its kind, others being in Germany and the UK and so forth. So it's a really big deal. Now, this 3AF has a committee called the Sigma Group where it's a commission, they call it, that investigates UFOs. And they've been investigating UFOs for a long time. In fact, we wrote a story in 2010 about a report that they had released where they said they agreed with some other high-ranking military officials and such that wrote a report in 1993 called the famous Cometa Report that some of you are aware of, where these officials said UFOs are real and they're very possibly extraterrestrial in origins. And 3AF said, we agree with that. We evaluated a lot of cases and we agree that it's a real phenomena of unknown origins and we can't rule out the extraterrestrial possibility. So it's really cool, really interesting. These are all very important people. We posted some pictures and everything. Leslie Kane is very close to CEFA-A. She covers their stuff a lot. So we have some quotes from her that she gave to Billy Cox of the Saratosa Herald Tribune. So really cool. I think this is really important.
I do too. And, you know, I was going to ask you about Leslie because I know she's been really a strong advocate to make something like this happen in more than one country. And you know, this could be the start of a domino effect of getting other countries to take a really good look at the situation.
I hope so. There's been a sort of domino effect in South America where Uruguay created a UFO organization and then Chile and then Argentina and Peru. So there's several of them down there, which is really cool. And these are government-sanctioned UFO organizations. Chile has kind of been on the forefront lately in creating these bridges with other organizations around the world. We actually had General Bermudez, who runs CEFA, at the International UFO Congress a few years ago, and he emphasized the importance of reaching out to the international community and building these bonds, and they've been doing that.
You just mentioned NARCAP with Richard Haynes? Am I thinking of the right?
You've got it.
Yeah. Who is allergic to a word that is part of my show, which is the word UFO.
Yeah, this is a big debate. You know, I have not heard much from people, and I know I use the word UFO constantly. If you don't use the word UFO, who's going to know what the heck you're talking about?
Right. A UAP, and they're going to look at you like you have two heads or something.
Yeah, so throughout this actual story, you know, in France they use the word pan, which is kind of like phenomena, anomalous, non-identificado, or something like that. I mean, it's this word pan. There's also AAP, aerial, anomalous aerial phenomena. So there's a lot of, you know, terms out there that are being used, UAP, PAN, AAP. But really, nobody knows what that means. And if you were to tell someone, oh, yeah, I investigate UAPs, they're going to go, what's a UAP? And you're going to go, a UFO. Oh, okay, now I know what you're talking about. So I know they're trying to get around the baggage of that comes with UFO, but I don't know that that's the way to do it, at least when we're trying to do outreach to the public. They know what UFOs are. I think we just have to demonstrate that UFOs are a credible phenomena, that there's credible research out there, and we got to change that kind of base idea of UFOs.
I agree. If they change the, let's just say tomorrow they change the word to UAP, well, all of a sudden there's going to be UAP hoaxes. There's going
exactly.
to be, you know, the little green men and UAPs and, you know, all that stuff. So,
I agree with you 100% there.
Yeah, it's just semantics.
Well, and even Leslie Kane's book, because she struggles with this as well, she used in her book the term UFOs, and it was a national, you know, New York Times bestseller. If she would have had UAPs, generals and officials go on the record, nobody would have known what the book was about, and it probably would have sold five or six copies.
Two copies, probably, yeah.
I would have bought.
Agreed.
Still, but.
So what else is happening?
All right. Well, I've got a Christmas story, but I'm going to save that towards the end. But what I want to just quickly go over are a couple sightings that are out there in the media. There's some sightings in Medellin, Colombia that have been getting a lot of attention. However, they're not as exciting as they seem to be. It looks like one of them is a balloon. The other one is it looks like a star balloon, and we posted that and explained all of this. And what's interesting about this is just a lot of people have reposted these original videos and gotten the facts wrong. So now in the media, when they're talking about it, all the facts are kind of mixed up and jumbled. So I wrote a story just to kind of clear up what are the base facts so people know, you know, what is real and what is not. But that's one that's going on. More interesting is a sighting in Leicestershire in the UK where there are these four kind of streaks going by in the air. At first, it was kind of assumed that they were part of the Geminids meteor shower, which was on the same day as the sighting. However, an astronomer has said he doesn't think that's the case. Instead, he thinks they're probably military jets in formation, and you're seeing their contrails, which might be the case, but so far they haven't found any confirmation of this. But that's kind of an interesting picture and a sighting that's out there. But speaking of the UK and bringing it back to the holidays, this is just kind of really interesting. The UK has been using UFO crashes in their school teaching. So a lot of the schools will stage a UFO crash, and local authorities will pretend they're part of, you know, they're investigating this. And the kids need to come out and investigate, do some science around it, and do some writing. But the UK's also been incorporating aliens into their nativity plays. So it's time for, you know, the holiday school plays. And it's more likely than not that if you are in the UK and you're going to go to a holiday play, that there's going to be aliens incorporated in that play. And I think that's really interesting and weird. Parents, there was a survey, are not so excited about this. But teachers argue, well, you're not the ones we're trying to excite. We're trying to excite the students. And they say that the students really respond to adding some aliens to the nativity plays.
It's probably just making it more interesting. And, you know, it's mm-hmm. all about things that we really don't know about when it comes to, you know, I mean, they're just stories handed down over the years, you know, the nativity scenes and all that. So why not add an alien or two, as long as they're not green?
Well, they're green.
They're green.
Sorry, buddy.
with Christmas ornaments on them, like a little tree.
No Christmas ornaments on them, but they're green with antennas and big eyeballs and stuff like that. They actually come in a variety. Some of them look a silvery aluminum kind of type, but I've got some pictures of the various types of aliens in the story. But sadly, I think this story, I think it's important sociologically that, you know, the whole idea of aliens, it's almost becoming a foregone conclusion, being integrated into schools. There are surveys out there that show students or children are more likely, younger people are more likely to believe in this sort of stuff, which just means that the whole idea of aliens, I think, is going to get more and more popular.
Well, we're linked to it in the show notes, so if you want to read that story, you can check it out there. I don't have anything, just to let you know, I don't have anything against green aliens. Whatever color they are, they're just fine with me. If they need to be green, it's okay. So, hey, speaking of things getting a little twisted, like your balloon stories. Last week, you had a story about the Italian astronaut up there on the International Space Station.
Right.
And sure enough, there's been stories out there, yeah, it was a UFO. She saw a UFO. So yep. Just like you said, that would probably happen. It happened.
I know how these things go, and that's why I try to clear these things up early on, but it's kind of cool because some people will repost, like the Phoenix Lights hoax thing that went out around a couple weeks ago. Link Itai and others are still out there saying, no, this one's been busted, check this story out.
Yes.
But what can you do, huh?
It sure is getting around that one, too, you're right. Hey, well, you have yourself a fine day, and thanks so much for the news today.
You too. We'll see ya.
So hang in there for the music break. We'll be right back with Robert Salas. Hello, Robert. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Is this Martin?
It is, yes. Welcome to Podcast UFO and to the Dark Matter Radio Network. And this is your second time on, but now it's all about you this time.
All about me.
Yes. So,
okay.
Robert, you're out in California. Is that right?
Yes. Ojai, California.
Oh, yeah. And also pretty warm these days compared to back here on the East Coast. If you could, can you, for the listener out there that is not familiar with your case, if you could just go over that. It's one of the most fascinating things, as far as I'm concerned, how these missiles all shut down. And you were basically, would you consider yourself a whistleblower?
Well, I don't know. I guess some people could call me that. I'm just interested in revealing the truth. I feel it's my responsibility to do so since I was there. I was a witness. And this is something I consider of great importance to everybody.
I do too. And I'm not, just to let you know, that I'm not using that term whistleblower as a bad thing. You know, I'm glad you came forward, and I'm glad a lot of, you know, that's, you know, I could go into a little bit of politics, but I'm not going to. But more whistleblowers now are, since the latest president is in, more whistleblowers are convicted when he said, you know, they would have protection. So it's an even tougher world for people to come forward than it was when you came forward with this. But if you can go all the way back to 1967 and you were right there, can you just describe what exactly happened?
Sure. I was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, which is Great Falls, Montana is where the base is located. But we had missile sites dotted throughout the state of Montana. And on March 24th, 1967, I was on duty along with my commander at a place called Oscar Flight. We were about 100 miles east of Great Falls near a little town called Roy, Montana. And on this evening, I'm on alert status. My commander's taking a little rest break, a little cot we had down there, because one of us had to be awake at all times. We had about six guards upstairs, and sometime in the evening hours, the main guard calls down and says they've been seeing strange lights in the sky, flying very fast, making 90-degree turns, that sort of thing, you know, typical. And they couldn't explain what they were. They said they were very fast-moving lights. They were under some kind of control, and they were not aircraft that they knew of. I wasn't really interested in the subject of UFOs at that time, even though we'd had some reports in the local newspaper, the Great Falls Tribune, of people reporting lights, but I kind of dismissed it. And then 5 minutes later, he calls back, and this time he's screaming into the phone. He's obviously frightened. He's got all the guards out there with their weapons out, and he said, "Sir, we're looking at the front gate area, and there's this glowing red object. It's just basically a large reddish-orange light pulsating, and it's just hovering there right above the front gate." He was scared to death, wanted me to tell him what to do next, and so basically I told him don't let anything inside the front gate. I was a little shocked. I didn't know exactly what was going on, but it seemed like we were under some sort of an attack, or someone was trying to get in our facility, which of course was highly sensitive. I hung up the phone, went to tell my commander about these phone calls, and all of a sudden the missile started shutting down. We went from a green status to a red no-go status, meaning the missiles could not be launched. And so we got a lot of bells and whistles going off. We also had a couple of security lights, meaning we had possibility of incursion at the launch facilities where the missiles were actually located. So I called back up. My commander went, called the command post. I called back up and ordered that they send guard teams out to two of the sites. And, of course, by then the UFO had left. So they sent two guards out to two of the sites, and they reported back that, again, they saw UFOs or lights hovering above the launch facilities where we had these indications. So after that call, my commander turns to me and says the same thing happened in another flight. At that time, I thought he meant that night, but later on I realized it was a week earlier. That was the Echo Flight incident. Echo Flight was another area or facility similar to mine. And again, 10 missiles were under their control, and all 10 missiles went down when UFOs were reported by security guards and maintenance people that they had on the sites. They were actually doing maintenance at the time. And all 10 of theirs shut down. So that happened about 8 days earlier. Within the span of 8 days, we lost 20 nuclear missiles to UFOs.
Amazing.
And I've got this well documented.
You know, reading a little bit about it here and there, and, you know, there was a serious investigation. We'll go into that. But when these things are all independently controlled, there's really hard. It's really hard for someone that's going to try to debunk the whole situation to come up with an easy answer for that. I've heard someone try to explain it. Maybe it had something to do with air conditioning or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. What are some of the things you've heard about people trying to knock this thing down?
Yeah, well, when I was on the Larry King show, I think this was, some years back. I don't even remember now. They had Bill Nye, the science guy.
Oh, yeah.
And he claimed he had a little report with him that said that the chiller unit, we had, the equipment we had in the capsule there was air-cooled. It had to be cooled because we were actually using, at that time, in 1967, some of the equipment we had in there, we were using old-fashioned radio tubes, if you can believe that.
Hmm.
And so we did have, it was cool down there. We had air-conditioned equipment. And he claimed that this air chiller unit had failed, but that's not correct. We did not lose power. We did not have a air chiller failure. As a matter of fact, the Boeing company did a complete investigation. They came back and said that they could find no plausible reason for this to happen. I'll base it on their investigation. This was the Boeing had the major contract for support of the Minuteman One system, and I've been in touch with the team leader, a man by the name of Robert Kaminsky, and I've got that information in my first book, Fated Giant. So, mm-hmm. No, it wasn't any kind of a failure that you can even imagine.
Right. We're on, if you're listening live, with Robert Salas. And if you want to jump in our chat room and ask some questions, go to podcastufo.com. Real simple sign in, and you can interact with guests and ask our guests, interact with people on the message board and ask our guests some questions. So, Robert, how long did this take before it actually got out, or did it get out right away, like in local news or something?
No, this was a classified incident. We were relieved the next morning by another crew. First thing I did is I went upstairs and talked to the main guard up there again to see if I can get more information on this. This was fantastic. It was highly, highly unusual. I was stationed there for 3 years as a crew commander, deputy crew commander, and nothing even similar to that ever happened. We didn't lose one missile to an unknown cause like this, much less 10. At any rate, we were helicoptered back, and we were ordered to go to our squadron commander's office, and in there was a member of AFOSI and my squadron commander. I asked if this was some kind of Air Force exercise. I didn't know if the Air Force had somehow did something as a sort of a readiness exercise. But he said, absolutely not. He's white as a sheet. He said he didn't know what the hell had happened. And then the guy from AFOSI shoved this piece of paper in our face and said, sign here. And what was this? It was a non-disclosure statement. We were never, ever to talk about it to anyone, not even people in the Air Force or spouses, nobody. And so we signed, and we were, and that was that. We never even got debriefed on the failure mode or anything like that, or the investigations going on. I was there for another 2 years. Nobody ever talked to me about it again.
Wow. Now, how long did it take for them to get the missiles that were knocked out active again?
About 24 hours, more or less. They had to send maintenance crews out to each missile separately and realign them. They had a specific alignment procedure where the missile had to be oriented properly. in order to accurately track on target.
Wow. Now, when you were, say, you were in this, I can't really understand exactly where it is, but I'm guessing that you're below ground level somewhere. And so you get this call, and how far away were you at that very time from the gate, you know, approximately?
Oh, well, we were 60 feet underground. In order to get upstairs, we would have to take an elevator and or, you know, climb a steel ladder. But we were not allowed to leave the capsule. We were locked in for 24 hours until relieved by crew, because obviously if that had been some kind of a terrorist attack, we would have, you know, and opened the huge door we had protecting the capsule, then, you know, we would have been derelict, because they could have had access to nuclear weapons.
Right.
So we were ordered, I mean, that was our order, standing orders. We were not to leave the capsule unless we were relieved by another crew.
All right.
So I never saw the object. This was simply reported to me.
Mm-hmm. I bet you wish you could have gone up just to take a look.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wish I had, but I couldn't. And from what I understand in talking to these guys later, they were extremely frightened by the whole affair.
Oh, I bet. Now, if someone was, let's just say, on this planet, you know, technology that we even have today, and they wanted to take an aircraft, let's say, and go over a nuclear missile and disarm it somehow, that there's nothing that we have, as far as you know, is there, that could disarm one?
No, absolutely not. Again, what this object did was send a specific signal through 60 feet of earth and concrete, and then penetrate our triply shielded cables against EMI, penetrate those and send signals to each of the missiles separately, and not only that, but to a particular part of each missile. This was the logic coupler, which connected the guidance system to the computers on the missile. So this is a fantastic feat. Even the Air Force stated, and I've got this in one of the documents we received, that this was highly improbable. Highly improbable is the word they use. But no, there's nothing even today that could do what that object did.
I mean, more or less, you could probably say that someone like you or someone that was involved in the technical part of these things could understand how it happens, but they couldn't understand how it actually occurred.
Right.
So did they, when they were doing their investigation, did they try to come up with answers, or did they just want to cover the whole thing up and just move on?
Yeah, it's interesting. There were two investigations actually ongoing. One was done by Boeing, which was a little more open kind of investigation. The other one was done by the Air Force. It was a classified investigation. In other words, and we don't have access to that report, but we do have, we did have, like I said, access to the team leader of the Boeing team. And he wrote us a long letter stating, you know, what they had looked at and could not find any, you know, practical or viable cause for the incident, the two incidents. And then later I heard from a friend of mine in the Air Force that the Air Force was still investigating this in 1972. So 5 years later, they were still trying to figure out what exactly had happened. You know, whether or not the Air Force ever concluded what exactly happened and how it happened, I don't know. It's probably still classified.
Right. Now, what was the connection with the event that happened a week earlier? Did they conclude exactly the same thing, or did a different thing type situation shut those warheads down?
No, they had the same failure mode, guidance and control system failure. But the documentation we got back had to do with their shutdown, the Echo Flight shutdown. Let me just back up a little bit. Remember, I didn't talk about this even after I got out of the Air Force. I resigned my commission in 1971, and I went to work in aerospace, mostly in FAA for 22 years. And then in 1994, I happened to be in a bookstore, picked up Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. Happened to turn to page 301 of that book and saw a short paragraph stating that in 1967, Dahlstrom Air Force Base UFO came over and shut down some missiles. Now, that was about it. That's all I read. But as a result of that, I thought, boy, maybe the Air Force declassified this incident, because how else would it wind up in Timothy Good's book? So I took a chance and asked a member of MUFON, an investigator at MUFON, to submit a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, to the Air Force about this flight of missiles going down in 1967. I said, don't mention anything about UFOs, just ask about it, see if we can get some documents on it. And sure enough, the Air Force wrote back, stated that this was still classified. However, since it's been so long, they were going to go ahead and declassify the incident and send us documents. So they started sending us what they had on the Echo Flight shutdown. Now, I thought this was my incident, so I started talking about it openly as a UFO event. Because I remember what happened, basically what happened. It took time to remember some of the details. But I thought that's where I was. It turns out I wasn't there. I was at Oscar Flight. I didn't find this out till a couple of years later when I finally got a hold of my commander, Fred Maiwald. And he told me that, no, we were not at Echo. We were at Oscar Flight. So... that's when I realized that, you know, I was open discussing this already. I'd been on a TV program, I think. I'd been on Sightings by then. And so I just had to make a decision. I just kept on talking about this. And it's been 20 years now, over almost 20 years. And nobody has ever approached me about not talking about this. But technically, I'm in violation of that non-disclosure statement.
Well, you know, a lot of people have clammed up about that. And it's funny. I think I remember something about someone who came forward on the Roswell case because of the same exact thing. They were at a store and saw it in print and said, oh, well, I guess that must mean it's declassified now. I can talk about it, you know. And yeah, which is pretty amazing. Now, going back to when this red glowing object, did you ever get to speak to the actual person about that, or did you have to just keep it quiet, the one who called you?
Well, briefly, I spoke to him when we got relieved that next morning by another crew. I went upstairs. First thing I did was talk to this guy. You know, he appeared to me as someone who didn't want to talk about it. I think his superiors had already gotten to him and told him to, you know, clam up and not say any more about this. But I was able to get out of him again. Basically, I asked him if there was a structure in that light. He said there was, he could barely see the outline of an oval-shaped structure. But the light was very bright, and it was a pulsating light, about 40, some 40, 50 feet. He said it was very large, and it was kind of a rough estimate that it was about 40 or 50 feet, because, again, there was it was a glow, basically a glowing reddish-orange light, but he did say that there was something inside the light. There was a structure there.
Hmm.
Other than that, he said they were all scared to death. Actually, one of the guards did get injured, but I think he got injured. He cut his hand trying to jump the fence, if you would, because he was so frightened. And we had barbed wire, of course, at the top of the fence.
Wow.
And he had cut his hand. He had to be sent back. A lot of these guys were dispersed. I never saw them again. Again, this was there another 2 years. So I never saw these guys again.
Really? You mean right away? They were dispersed
exactly.
Right away?
They were shipped out to different bases. And the reason they do that is because they don't want them, you know, comparing notes, getting together, and causing trouble. Also, if we can talk, you want to talk about this now, the Condon investigation was ongoing at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another reason for this this big secrecy that they imposed on us.
About that at the same time. Now, before we move on from that, did any one of the guards out there consider drawing a gun on this thing, or, you know, trying to defend the...
Actually, I recently got a report from an airman that was there, not at my facility exactly, but he was there at the time, and he knew the guard that had gotten his hand cut, and he thinks that he actually fired his weapon at this object. Of course, to no avail. There was no effect on him, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Now, there's another incident, which I talk about in my book. That's the Ellsworth 1976 incident. And in that case, there were 180 rounds fired at the object. Similar to mine, it hovered over the facility, and the guards just unloaded their weapons on it, and about 180 rounds. And again, to no effect, didn't impact it one way or the other.
I think I'd be more scared after if I fired something at it than I'd be... And doing anything else. I mean, you just automatically would think that this thing would, you know, just like you see in the movies, send out a laser or something and just fry you right where you are. You know, I mean, if it got here, it definitely has, and it can actually disarm nuclear warheads. That's the last thing
I'd do. That's another point. This object could have damaged our equipment, and it did not.
Mm.
There was no damage per se. All it did was send a signal to each of the missiles, upset the guidance system, and disable the missiles. They could not be launched.
You know, in a way, I think it also sent a signal to us. You know, that's I've had Robert Hastings on before, and we basically talked about this. I asked him what he thought this was, and you know, do you feel the same way that this is a message?
Yeah, that was my my conclusion, that this was simply a message, and the message is get rid of your nuclear weapons, because this has not happened not just at Malmstrom. By the way, it happened at Malmstrom again in 1975. But it's happened at many other bases where the UFO just flies over, maybe shines a beam of light on the weapon storage area where nuclear weapons are held, and flies off. That's what happened at Bentwaters Base in England in 1980. The UFO shone a beam of light in the weapon storage area. It happened at Aviano Air Base in Italy in 1979. UFO comes over, shines a beam of light near the weapons storage area, flies off. It's happened many other times, And I think it's just they're just trying to basically shine a light on our nuclear weapons. And I think the message is get rid of these things. So I go into a great deal in my new book, Unidentified, on the nuclear issue, which is one of my main concerns, and that's nuclear weapons. We can go into that later, I guess.
Yeah, we can go back into your book in the second hour, which is coming up in only 15 minutes. You know, the one thing I can never understand, you know, like to say, let's just say they are trying to send us a message, and I can't imagine any other explanation for it, you know, for myself. It just seems like that is the most logical conclusion that I can think of. But, you know, I wonder what it would actually take for us to take this whole thing serious. Like, hey, we're getting a message here. If you know, it doesn't seem like it connects to the right people to actually make any changes. And, you know, I mean, once these babies are built, it's so hard to reverse what we have going on here as far as being, you know, equipped to kill each other. You know, there was a little bit of disarmament that started. I don't know where that is now. And as a matter of fact, it seems to me that I read something recently that they're going to rebuild a bunch of nuclear weapons to get them back in shape again. What is your,
right.
You know, I know you were the guy down there on the trigger. What do you think about the arms race in general at this point in your life?
Yeah, we're still in a very precarious situation with regard to nuclear weapons. We have 9 nuclear states now, including Pakistan, including India, including North Korea. It's clear that North Korea has actually done nuclear testing, and they do have a nuclear weapon. There's still a lot of weapons-grade material out there that has not been accounted for after this fall of the Soviet Union. There's still a lot of nuclear material out there that could be used to build a dirty bomb. And you can bet that these terrorist organizations are trying to get a hold of that material and actually build a dirty bomb because it could cause havoc in any major city. We did have a New START treaty with Russia where the U.S. and Russia were going to reduce their nuclear stockpiles to 1,500 weapons, active weapons, and we were going to exchange in inspections. Now the inspectors were going to inspect our facilities to make sure that happened. In fact, we did reduce the number of new nuclear weapons. I don't think we got down to 1,500 yet. We probably got something like 2,000 or more, in submarines and land-based, in missiles. And possibly, and also bombs for bombers. Although we did eliminate, I think it was the B-1 bomber capability for carrying nukes, but we still have the B-2. But since the crisis in Ukraine with Russia, that's all up in the air now.
Right.
I certainly don't know what the current status is. With regard to the inspection program, but the other critical issue, of course, is trying to get an agreement with Iran, which hopefully will come to a head here within the next couple of months. But it's still a very dangerous world out there with regard to nukes, and we still have to focus on reducing the number of nuclear weapons we have worldwide.
I sure would like that myself. And you know, what about nuclear power plants? That's something I can't remember if I spoke to Robert Hastings about that or not. Has there been any tampering? I mean, is it Is there anything, because, you know, those are actually pretty dangerous, too. And not only that, something they never, ever talk about when it comes to nuclear power plants is the waste. And the waste is the most, you know, the worst part of the whole thing, because we are putting the burden on people 200,000 years from now that, you know, are going to be born and have to worry about the waste. It's still going to be active. As far as you know, has anyone tampered with nuclear power plants?
Well, there have been UFO sightings over nuclear power plants. One of these, one of the stories I've got in my book goes back to 1945, even before the first nuclear bomb was exploded. UFOs were seen over the Hanford nuclear facility near Hanford, Washington, which was producing plutonium for the first nuclear bombs. And it was chased by chase planes. And that happened a couple of times. That was in 1945.
Wow.
UFOs were seen over Chernobyl. There was actually an article in Pravda, the Russian newspaper, people witnessing UFOs flying over Chernobyl both before and after the meltdown there at Chernobyl.
Very interesting.
They know about our nuclear power efforts, and again, this is highly, highly dangerous, as we know from the Fukushima disaster.
Right, which still isn't over yet.
No, it's still in a disaster. They don't know the entire impact of that yet.
Mm-hmm. And it's still not out of the woods as far as being safe and.
Okay, no, you know. That's right.
Yeah. So as far as weapons are concerned, do you know of any other type of weapons that anything has, you know, anyone has reported that has been disarmed as well besides nuclear?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Okay, sure. What I mean is, say, a non-nuclear weapon of mass destruction, if they're, you know, like a missile or something. I know there was that one down in California where they sent up a dummy and, you know, was hit by a laser. But as far as you know, is there any other incident similar to that when it's not a nuclear warhead, but
well, I know during the missile testing that they did in the Sandia Range in New Mexico, there were UFO sightings there. And, of course, these didn't have nuclear warheads, but, of course, some of them were probably going to be, you know, designed for carrying nuclear weapons. But yeah, there were. This was in the, I believe, it was in the 50s. There were many reports of UFOs being seen in the test range where these missiles were being tested.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now I spoke with. I've said this on a couple of shows, and I don't really want to be redundant, but I did speak with someone many years ago that said they were involved in a special part of the Air Force in the early 70s, late 60s. That investigated UFOs. He didn't say Project Blue Book or anything like that, but he just said that he was actually in Vietnam investigating UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, there's definitely been sightings in Vietnam. Matter of fact, I think General Brown, I believe his name was, actually confirmed to some of the troops over there that there were indeed UFO sightings over Vietnam. And then I've gotten reports from veterans who had served in Vietnam and actually reported to me that they'd seen them also. Well, another story in my book is a story by Mark Koch, who was a squadron platoon leader, platoon sergeant. And his platoon saw a very large triangular-shaped UFO over a little town called Makassib, which is south of Baghdad Airport, and this was in 2006. UFOs have been observed, in our theaters of war, let's say. So they're not only they're of course interested in, these are sentient beings, I believe. In other words, they're intelligent beings that are watching our progress and to see how we are coping with ourselves, basically. So they're watching our wars. They're watching the kinds of weapons we're developing. I think, and they've been doing this for some time, I think probably thousands of years, they've been observing us.
I tend to agree with everything you just said there. And the final part of this same gentleman I was speaking about earlier, talking about Vietnam, he also said, I said, well, what does a government, think they are? That's what I asked him. And he said, we're more or less a petri dish. I thought that was a very interesting statement. And that kind of goes along with what you're saying here.
So yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so here you are. We got about 3.5 minutes to the top of the hour. So here you are. You are a young officer. You're working there, and your life totally changes in just one instant. Did you kind of just suppress the thoughts and the feelings and of the whole situation and just kind of put it in the back of your mind until that day when you saw Timothy Good's book?
Well, initially, of course, after I was ordered not to talk about it, I was confused. I was a little upset. This was a very significant event. You know, we were professional, tried to be professional about our jobs, and our job was basically to maintain nuclear weapons and have them ready. And here we have a situation where these weapons were disabled. And we didn't know why. And by the way, we would be briefed every time we went out on alert status as to any problems in the field, any difficulties with the equipment, etc. But we were never, in the next 2 years, debriefed about that. So I was very curious, let's say, initially. But hanging over me was this non-disclosure statement. So gradually and ultimately, I basically tried to put this way back in the back of my mind because I didn't want to be talking about this in some bar and then, be prosecuted for disclosing classified information. So, yeah, by 1994, I really hadn't thought about this much at all. However, it never left my memory, the basic incident never left. And so, yeah, I was kind of interested in the UFO question after that. And that's how I wound up picking up Timothy Good's book up in 1994.
And when you said that you contacted MUFON, and how did it snowball to you actually being interviewed on television? What made that happen?
Well, basically, I started talking after we received documents from the Air Force saying that the Echo Flight incident had been declassified. And I was convinced that that was my incident because, the memories that I did have at that time kind of fit in with the facts of the Echo Flight shutdown. I went public. I think I can't remember now which programs I went on. I started giving newspaper interviews. I actually went back to Malmstrom and gave an interview to the Great Falls Tribune, and they actually published it front page. I've still got a copy of that. Huh. I felt that I should talk about this as a UFO event. The Air Force, in the documents they sent us, never claimed that there were any UFOs involved in this, but I knew better. Hmm. And that's when I started going public.
Now, one last question for this part of the show. And that is, did you ever meet Tim Good, and did you ever talk to him about it, where he got his information?
Yes, I did meet Tim Good, and we finally figured out where we got the information, and I can go into that if you have time now, or I can wait.
Yeah, let's finish this up so we don't get the first hour people okay. unhappy like last week. So go
okay.
ahead. Yeah.
All right. One of the people that was working at Sylvania at the time of the shutdowns was a man by the name of Ray Fowler. And you may recognize that name. But
yes.
Mm-hmm. Fowler had a crew at Malmstrom on the electrical systems. And those people told Fowler that of these shutdowns and that they were UFO events. In fact, one of his crewmen actually saw the UFO. So when the Condon investigation started, Fowler contacted the Condon committee and told them this. And actually, the head investigator for Condon, man by the name of Roy Craig, and we can talk about this more. Talked to Condon, got some details. Condon went ahead and whitewashed this whole thing. And Ray Fowler was so upset with that he decided to give the Christian Science Monitor an interview about the incident. And in 1973, he actually gave an interview to the Christian Science Monitor about the missile shutdowns at Malmstrom, and they published it.
Hmm.
Even though Fowler was taking a big risk with his job. But that is how Timothy Good found out about the Echo Flight shutdown and published that part of it in his book. It was published in the Christian Science Monitor in 1973.
How about that? Well, that's it for the show today. Remember, you can listen to the second hour of the show by becoming a subscriber for as low as $1 per month. All that information is on our website, podcastufo.com. Get Joy Ride is the service. And I got an email from someone this week that said they love the show, but based on principle that I am charging for the second half, they will never come back. So I understand this way of thinking, but if you would like to listen to the second half, but for some reason you're having trouble with payments or something on getjoyride.com, please let me know so they can address the situation, because they said that they want everything to go smoothly and they will take care of whatever the issues are. So whether it's a credit card type payment or PayPal or there's some other way you would like to pay but can't, please let me know at martin@podcastufo.com. We just want to get these things straightened out. Once again, the contest we have, if you want to win a brand new mini iPad or iPad mini, I guess they call them, or a fun swag bag full of all kinds of great stuff, just go to gemmer.com, G-E-M-R.com, register, post as many things as you'd like, and send an email to contest@gemmer.com. with only your username in the subject line. All that information is in our show notes. And if you forget this, it's right on podcastufo.com. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Alejandro Rojas for the news, our guest, Bob Salas, Kerry Lloyd Whitehouse for our music, Peggy Shunning for managing our very busy Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. We have the Flatwoods Monster, Frank Fascino Jr. coming on next week. And you can check back with us live and listen if you'd like to every week on the Dark Matter Radio Network, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you.